the main themes we've been looking at in the last few weeks has been the notion of dharma, which we've seen primarily in the context of the Dharma Shastras, literally the texts on dharma, the treatises on dharma, which are these texts that understand dharma primarily in relation to the Varnashrama dharma. So the dharma of the Varnas, the four Varnas, the four social classes of Brahmana, priests, Kshatriya, warrior, king, Vaishya, merchant, farmer, and Shudra, laborer, and the four ashramas, which we've talked about last week, of celibate studentship, where you memorize the Veda under the guidance of a guru, the brahmacharya, then grihastha, householder life, where you get married, you have children, you expand the family, perform Vedic rituals, the vanaprastha stage, where you live a married life, but a sort of a more ascetic married life, and finally, the one we focused on last week, the ashrama, the stage of life of sannyasa, of renunciation, where you renounce the world and become a monk who wanders around begging for his livelihood, and so a life of asceticism. And so the Dharma Shastras, as we've seen, come to accept these sort of four varnas and four ashramas, where they talk about the duties and responsibilities of the different varnas, of the different social classes, and advocate sort of a model of the four ashramas, the four stages of life, which come to be, which initially are seen as sort of optional. You can choose. I mean, it all starts with brahmacharya, with study of the Vedic text, but then the earliest Dharma Shastra texts kind of give the option of where you want to go with that. You can stay a celibate student for the rest of your life. You can get married. You can become a monk. But then later on, it comes to be seen as sort of a gradation, a succession of stages of life. In a sense, the notion of dharma is something that pervades almost every Hindu text. They're all responding to this, all interpreting this in a particular way. But kind of generally, when people think of dharma, they think of the Dharma Shastras. But what we'll do today is we'll look at two different texts that are some of the most popular texts in Indian culture. And I say Indian culture and not Hindu culture, because these texts have had an influence far beyond the sort of the Hindu religious world in the Indian subcontinent. And they're two narrative texts. They're two texts that talk about the lives of certain individuals. Two very epic texts, texts that focus on the lives of kings, but that are really in some ways two Dharma Shastras, two texts, not in the technical sense of the Dharma Shastras as we've seen, but that are two texts that comment on dharma and that give you a different perspective on what dharma is specifically for kings, but as we will see, they touch on the other social classes as well and talk of dharma in more general terms. And those are the texts of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. And the Ramayana and the Mahabharata are, as I mentioned, some of the most popular texts in South Asia and beyond. The Ramayana had a strong influence too on Southeast Asia. And they're these types of texts that anyone sort of growing up in that culture knows these texts, even if they've never read this. A.K. Ramanujan, who was a scholar at the University of Chicago, famously said that in India, no one reads the Ramayana for the first time, because everyone that comes to read the Ramayana has already heard the Ramayana so many times and so many versions of the Ramayana, that you can never read it for the first time. It's just part of the entire culture. And the same can be said for the Mahabharata. And it's these two texts together with a Puranic text about, which we will talk more in 2 weeks' time, a tech sculpt the Bhagavata Purana. We'll say more about this in 2 weeks. But it's these three texts that pretty much, you could say, 90% of all Indian art and of all expressions of art, whether it's performative art or sculpture or narrative, they all go back to these three texts. These three texts have had an enormously powerful influence, the narratives that are portrayed in these texts. It's later poets will retell the stories of these texts, change the stories of these texts. There's a lot of later authors who disagree with the way things are portrayed there, and they retell it in their own way. It's temple sculpture and so on the decorations on temples, dance styles and so on. Drama tradition is basically all a retelling of these three, or nearly all a retelling of these three texts. I don't know how familiar you are with these texts. I'll kind of briefly tell the story of these texts. But what I want to focus on today is kind of looking at these texts as texts that really, not just about the story, but that really are commenting on Dharma. These two, this one we'll do later, that these two texts both share something with each other. They have there's some ideas that they share, but there's a very big difference between the way these two texts look on Dharma. Before we get into these texts, one of the reasons these texts are so popular is not just because they're narrative texts, but it's also because these texts themselves present themselves as being more widely accessible to people. These texts present themselves as being Vedic texts, as being texts that come in the tradition of the Vedas that we've been talking about, but at the same time open up this tradition to a much wider audience. If you remember, the Shudras, the fourth class of traditional Hindu society, is not allowed to study the Vedas. They're not initiated into Vedic study. They don't have a period of brahmachari, of studenthood, studying the Veda under a guru. So they're barred from the study of Vedic texts. Similarly, women in the Dharma Shastras are prohibited from studying Vedic texts. Particularly a text like the Mahabharata, and will very boldly proclaim that this is the Vedic text that is accessible to anyone, and it doesn't make any restrictions on social background or gender. So the way it portrays the Mahabharata more so than the Ramayana, but the way the Mahabharata portrays itself is it's saying, this, I am the fifth Veda. And we have the four Vedas that we've talked about in previous weeks, the Rig Veda, the Sama Veda, the Yajur Veda, and the Atharva Veda. And the Mahabharata proclaims that I am the fifth Veda, and I am teaching exactly what the Vedic texts are teaching, but this text is open to Shudras and to women as well. And often the third category is added to that list of a term we've seen before, of the Brahma Bandhus, of the relatives of the Brahmins. Those who are born in Brahmin families but do not have the aptitude to be a proper Brahmin. Sometimes the Mahabharata also proclaims, I'm for these people as well, they can read me as well. And the idea of there being this fifth Veda that is the Mahabharata, or that is the, as the Mahabharata itself calls itself, it says it's an Itihasa, which is Itihasa, thus indeed it was, which is sort of often translated as history. And there's another group of texts which we'll see in 2 weeks, which is Purana, which means an old text, or Purana literally means old or ancient, so those texts that deal with sort of forgotten histories and so on. And both of these groups, so the Mahabharata, which is an Itihasa, and the Puranas, which is a separate corpus of texts that we'll talk about in 2 weeks' time, they both proclaim to be the fifth Veda, and they often do it with reference to Vedic texts themselves. And if you look at the handout, at the beginning of the handout, you have two passages from the Upanishads, The first from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, and the second is a passage we've seen already from the Chandogya Upanishad. But if you look there on the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad passage, it says it is like this: as clouds billow from a fire lit with damp fuel, so indeed this immense being, Brahman, has exhaled all this, the Rig Veda, Yajurveda, Samaveda, and Atharva Angirasa, which is the Atharva Veda, the histories, the Itihasa, the ancient tales, the Puranas, the sciences, hidden teachings, verses, aphorisms, explanations, and glosses. It is that immense being who has exhaled all this. And if you look at the second passage, which we looked at a few weeks ago, where Narada approaches Sanat Kumara and says, I've studied every Vedic text that there is to study, but still I'm ignorant of who I am, so please teach me that there. He says the same thing if you look at the third line down. I've studied the Rig Veda as also the Yajurveda, the Samaveda, the Atharvana as the fourth, the corpus of histories, Itihasa, and ancient tales, Purana, as the fifth Veda among the Vedas, ancestral rites, and so on and so forth. And so you get this notion from these texts that these are the sort of the fifth Veda, that there is this fifth Veda which contains a narrative text, which tells stories of bygone days. And it's the Puranas and the Mahabharata kind of allude to this and say we are those texts. And commentators on those texts, on the Puranas and so on, will often cite these verses as sort of proof that these texts are on an equal level as the Veda and therefore should be given the same respect. Whether these passages actually do refer to these texts, that's up for debate. Several commentators on the Upanishads don't interpret it in this light. They just say these are stories that would have been told at sacrificial performances, but not these texts. It's a separate category. And many scholars would sort of support this notion that basically these texts are sort of later on kind of claimed, sort of linking it back to this. But whether the Brihadaranyaka and the Chandogya indeed have these texts in mind or not is somewhat irrelevant from the perspective of these texts, because these texts clearly align themselves with it. Now, particularly the Mahabharata is very bold in this claim, and it's kind of the idea that develops in the ritual context already, is that we have two categories of texts, and we have on the one hand Shruti texts, which is the Vedic revelation, which are the four Vedas, including the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, and the Upanishads, those supplementary texts that we've talked about in previous weeks. And these are traditionally seen to have no author there, which is interpreted variously in non-theistic traditions. It's interpreted that these texts are eternal, they have eternally existed, they have no beginning and no end, and they just manifest in sort of the lives of in the life in humanity at various times when sages perceive these texts, but these texts are eternally existent. Theistic traditions will interpret that as being that God reveals these texts at the beginning of creation, as we have in this passage from the Brihadaranyaka, where it says that this immense being Brahman sort of emanated, exhaled these texts, manifested these texts from its being. And these texts are traditionally to be seen as to have the highest authority because they are not of a human, or they're not written by a human person. They're seen to be infallible on matters of dharma, particularly, and for the Upanishads, then on matters of knowledge of Brahman. And therefore, these texts have the highest authority. Now, a lot of other texts, the various ritual texts that we've talked about in previous weeks, the various sutras, those ritual manuals that are written that are associated with each Vedic text, if you remember that complex table on a previous handout, as well as, for example, the Dharmashastras, as well as the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, these are traditionally acknowledged to have human authors. These are traditionally seen to have been written by specific people at specific times, generally associated, and the name of these texts is generally the name of the author. So you have the Vodayana Dharma Sutra, which is the Dharma Sutra that is said to be written by Vodayana, and the Manava Dharma Shastra, which is said to be written by by Manu and so on. And so these are texts that have an origin. There's a time when these texts did not exist, and then these texts come to be written by a specific person. And so these have a secondary authority, and these are considered to be smriti, to be memory. So shruti means hearing. Again, sort of stressing the oral nature of these texts. So these the Vedic texts are considered to be those that are heard from the guru, and those that are memorized in that way. Whereas the other texts that are written by individuals are said to be smriti, literally memory, and we'll come back to why they're called memory in a moment. But the idea is that these texts have authority on matters of dharma or matters of knowledge of Brahman, depending on what tradition you belong to. But their authority is secondary, because they cannot teach anything that is not taught in these Shruti texts. And so whatever they say, they merely expand upon or elucidate or elaborate on the ideas of the Vedic text. And this is an idea that originates in ritual circles. And so you see this very clearly with the ritual manuals that are compiled, where they say step by step, here's how you do these rituals that are talked about in the Vedic text. And so these texts are clearly kind of saying, we're not inventing these rituals. We're just referring to what these texts, the Vedic texts here are saying, but we're making it more systematic. We're kind of giving you a step-by-step guideline on how to do this. And so our authority depends entirely on these texts, and we're merely pointing the reader to these texts and to help them understand how to properly pursue what these texts are teaching. And with the Dharmashastras too, there is that sort of notion there as well, particularly with the earliest Dharmashastric texts, these Dharma Sutras, where they too are kind of saying, what we are teaching is implied in these Vedic texts. We're just merely sort of elaborating on how you would then sort of translate the ideals of Vedic ritual into everyday life, and how you kind of would live your life based on this. But again, they would say the primary authority is the Shruti text, and that's where everything is found. Now, the Mahabharata, for example, would claim that as well. The Puranas would claim that as well. These are traditionally also sort of labeled under a very broad umbrella term of smriti, of memory. And there too they claim, we're not teaching anything new. Whatever we're teaching is there in the Vedic text. We're just elaborating on it, making it more easily accessible, and so on. And so the traditional analogy that is given is that you cannot remember that which you have not heard before. And so therefore the smriti cannot teach anything new that the Shruti has not taught before. And this works really well in a very simple way with the earliest ritual manuals and so on that we've talked about. But this becomes a lot more complicated with a text like the Mahabharata, for example, which is a narrative text, and which includes a lot of deals with a wide range of topics that not always or don't always seem to be covered in Vedic texts. And this is where you get sort of the second idea of this being smriti text. And this is something that originates, the second meaning of why these texts are called memory, is something you find already in Dharmashastric texts, where sometimes Dharmashastras would teach something that we don't find necessarily in Vedic texts. And authors on Dharmashastra would say, ah yes, because these texts are the memory of these Vedic texts. In the sense that some of the Vedic texts are lost, but the teachings of the lost Vedic texts are preserved in the memory of these Dharmashastric texts. And therefore, these texts are important because they give you access to ideas that over the centuries have lost. And so it kind of becomes a way of, how are you going to look at these texts? How will you evaluate the importance of these smriti texts? You can say, yes, their authority is secondary, because you cannot remember that which you have not heard before. But you can also say, well, these texts are more important because they preserve things. They're the memory of texts that have been lost, and therefore it's better to study these because you get a bigger picture. And it's this sort of notion that a text like the Mahabharata particularly plays on. And you have two passages there from the Mahabharata, from the very beginning of the text, where it makes this bold claim. And if you look at the third passage you have there on the handout, this is from the first chapter of the Mahabharata. And the Mahabharata is an enormous text. It's 100,000 verses long, so it's quite a significant text that has a sort of a narrative that runs through it, but has all these digressions into various sort of didactic passages and sub-stories and so on, as we will see in a moment. But at the very beginning of this text, it makes this bold claim. It says, by the aid of history and the Puranas, by the aid of the Itihasa, basically the Mahabharata, and these other narrative texts of the Puranas, the Veda may be expounded. But the Veda is afraid of one of little information, lest he should hurt it. So someone who doesn't know the Veda very well is dangerous because they can distort the Vedic teaching. So no knowledge is better than a little knowledge, basically. That's the idea here. The learned man who recites to others this Veda Vyasa reaps advantage. It may without doubt destroy even the sin of killing the embryo and the like. The man who with reverence daily listens to this sacred work acquires long life and renown and ascends to heaven. The person who is named here, Vyasa, he's traditionally seen as the author of the text. And there's a lot of the... He's actually a character in the text itself as well. Vyasa is one of the characters in the Mahabharata. And in many of the Puranas, which are the texts he is said to have written as well. Scholars disagree on both the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, whether these texts were written by a single individual or were kind of gradually sort of acquired more and more material and came to be the texts that we now know over a period of various centuries. And that's a very sort of vigorous debate amongst Ramayana and Mahabharata scholars up to this day. And you have scholars who are on either side of that debate. And so it says here, this text is important. Merely reading this text will cleanse you of all sort of transgressions of Dharma. It goes on, it says, in former days, having placed the four Vedas on one side and the Bharata, the Mahabharata, on the other, these were weighed in the balance by the celestials, by the gods assembled for that purpose. And as the latter weighed heavier than the four Vedas with their mysteries, from that period it has been called in the world the Mahabharata, or the Great Bharata, being esteemed superior both in substance and gravity of import. It is dominated Mahabharata on account of such substance and gravity of import. He that knows its meaning is saved from all his sins. And so what the Mahabharata is saying, we put the Veda, all the Vedic texts and the Mahabharata itself on a scale and sort of see which one is heavier, which one is more important. The Mahabharata outweighs all the four Vedic texts itself. And so it's making this very bold claim that this is the most important text you can read. And indeed, I think you have that in the... do you have it in the next passage? No, actually you don't. Sorry. But both in the very beginning of the Mahabharata as well as at the very end of the Mahabharata, the Mahabharata claims that whatever is found elsewhere is found in this text. Whatever is not found in here is not found anywhere else. Which is quite a bold claim to make for a text. So whatever is here, whatever is elsewhere is here, whatever is not here is nowhere else. Basically, everything that is there to know is contained within this text. And so it sets itself up as this sort of text of sort of the king of all texts, the most important of all texts, that preserves within its memory lost Vedic ideas, that makes reference to the Vedic texts, as it says, throughout the Mahabharata, that this is the teachings of the Vedic text, but that is not just more wider in scope than the surviving Vedic text, but is also making all of that more accessible, because as the Mahabharata proclaims, the Mahabharata is the fifth Veda, which is the Veda for the Shudras and the women as well as everyone else, but they have access to this as well. yeah. Now, one of the big things that the things that the Ramayana and the Mahabharata have in common is not just that they're these grand epic stories that are told, but also that they introduce a new idea, and that is the idea in relation to dharma, and that is the notion of the avatara. Now, avatara literally means the descent, and it's the idea that both of these texts revere or consider Vishnu to be supreme. And both of these texts, Vishnu is a Vedic deity, is found in Vedic texts, and is a Vedic deity that's very strongly associated with the sacrifice itself. In the Brahmana text, Vishnu is repeatedly identified with the sacrifice itself as sort of the embodiment of sacrifice. Vishnu becomes one of the most prominent deities in the Hindu traditions, and as the focus of worship for a whole host of traditions, whereas the other primary deity is Shiva, about whom we will see more later. Both of these have Vedic roots, but kind of take off in their own importance in very dramatic ways, and have a whole series of traditions associated with their worship. But the Ramayana and the Mahabharata proclaim Vishnu to be the supreme being, and equate Vishnu, particularly the Mahabharata, with Brahman. And as we've seen in the Upanishads, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, last week we saw the claim that the ritualists make the claim that the order that we find in the world, the rita, is maintained by our actions, by our pursuance of dharma, by our practice of Vedic ritual, whereas the Upanishads say, no, it is Brahman that causes the rita. Beyond the sacrifice is the power of the sacrifice, is the power of Brahman. And it is Brahman who, if you remember that passage from the Brihadaranyaka, it is Brahman who sets the sun and moon apart, who keeps day and night from crashing into each other, who makes the rivers flow to the ocean, and so on. And so here in the Mahabharata and Ramayana is the notion that Brahman, who is identified with Vishnu, who is identified with sacrifice in the Brahmana text, periodically descends into this world as an avatara, appears in this world to re-establish dharma. And the most famous proclamation of that you find there at the bottom of page 1 in the Bhagavad Gita, about which we will talk next week, which is a part of the Mahabharata, which is 18 chapters of the Mahabharata that are often treated as an independent text, where it declares that whenever there is a decline in dharma, or Bharata, the person who is being addressed, and whenever there is an increase in adharma, then I manifest myself for the protection of the righteous, for the destruction of the wrongdoers, and for the purpose of establishing dharma, I appear age after age. And so the notion of dharma kind of gets this new complexity to it, that Vishnu, who is Brahman, who is responsible for the upholding of dharma, periodically descends into this world, appears in this world to teach dharma, to re-establish dharma, and to make sure that adharma, the opposite of it, is vanquished. And both of these texts are really, in some sense, the accounts of the lives of these avatars. The Ramayana is the story of Rama, who's in the first and the last book of the Ramayana proclaimed to be an avatar of Vishnu. That's part of the debates among scholars. Those who argue that Ramayana is being sort of put together over various centuries argue that the first and the last book, which clearly proclaim Rama to be an avatar of Vishnu, to be later additions, whereas other Ramayana scholars argue that those two part cannot be considered later because they're sort of integral to the narrative of the text. Anyway, that's kind of the debate amongst there. Whereas the Mahabharata is about the life of Krishna, who is also considered to be an avatar of Vishnu. And both of these texts talk about the avatars in relation to Dharma, and both of these texts tell the life of these avatars, these descents of Vishnu into this world, and try to show how these avatars try to establish Dharma. And the most straightforward of the two is the Ramayana in doing this. The Ramayana is a very straightforward text. It is mostly just concerned with the story of Ram, has very little digressions, at least compared to the Mahabharata, and just tells the story of Ram, shows how Ram, who descends the ideal king, he's a Kshatriya, born into a family of kings, a lineage of kings, he's the crown prince, but who is then, due to intrigues at the court, just before his coronation, banished from the kingdom, spends much of his life in exile in the forest with his wife Sita and his brother Lakshmana. While he's in the forest, his wife Sita gets kidnapped by Ravana, by a king from the traditionally sort of seen from the south, from Lanka, from Sri Lanka. Rama and Lakshman and his brother then go to search for Sita, find out that she's been kidnapped by Ravana, and then finally wage a war with Ravana to reclaim Sita. And Rama, because he's an exiled king, he has no army. His army becomes the monkeys and the bears and the vultures and so on from the forest, who aid him into the fight. And he defeats Ravana, returns to Ayodhya, to the capital where he was from, and when his banishment is over, and becomes then the ideal king. Now, the way the Ramayana portrays it, the Ramayana is a very sad story, actually. It's a very beautiful, very poetic story. It's traditionally considered to be the Adi Kavya, the first poem, the first poetic composition. But it's a very sad story because Rama embodies Dharma, but embodies Dharma in such a way that it is painful to read it. When Rama is banished from the kingdom, what happened, the backstory is that the king Dasharatha has several wives, and as is often the case, at least as we can gather from text and sort of about written at the court, there was a lot of political intrigue amongst the queens about which son would become the successor to the throne. Ram is the eldest son, is supposed to become the king, but due to a political intrigue with one of the wives, the Dasharatha, the king, had promised anything to her whenever she wanted, she comes and claims and said, okay, my son should be king and you should banish Ram. And Ram is because his father is sort of bound to banish him by that oath he took to his second wife, he banishes her. But no one in the kingdom wants Ram to leave. But Ram sort of is the embodiment of Dharma. He says, truthfulness is a great virtue. My father told me to go away, even though my father does not want me to go away. Even though there's ways in which I can avoid being exiled, he says, I must do what my father commands. And therefore I will go to the forest. And so he upholds the principles of Dharma in a way that is kind of almost painful to read, where he sort of takes it to its very extreme. And this comes out most prominently at the very end of the book, which is why it's a sad story, is at the very end of the story, Rama is reunited with his wife, with Sita, and they return to Ayodhya, to the kingdom. He becomes king, and he's ruling as a just, exemplary king over his subjects and with his wife. But there's rumors that circulate that he hears about, that some of the citizens are saying that, oh, what was Sita really doing when she was kidnapped by Ravana? She must have been unfaithful to Ram. And how can he, as the proper king, take her back? Now, the Ramayana has a whole sort of backstory to this, where Ravana cannot lay hands on Sita, because if he does, he's cursed, he will die, and so on, if he forces himself upon a woman, and because he has done so in the past. And anyway, there's a sort of, so the Ramayana makes it very clear that Sita is the absolutely sort of the chaste wife. She's never been interested in Ravana. Ravana did not lay a hand on her. But Rama hears that his citizens, some of his citizens are questioning whether she has remained faithful to him. And so he decides that as a Dharmic king, the proper thing to do is to banish my wife. And because if my citizens have no faith in me as the proper king and question my Dharmic value, then how can I rule them? And so even though he's in love with her, he banishes her, and they live for the rest of their life separately. She lives in the hermitage of a sage, and he makes a golden image of Sita that he places on the throne and rules alongside her. It's the part of the story that in all the retellings of the Ramayana always gets left out. In all the retellings of the Ramayana ends with Rama and Sita happily together back in Ayodhya, because it's the most painful part of the story. How can Rama, who's the embodiment of virtue, how can he banish his wife, who has not done nothing wrong, based on a rumor that his sort of citizens are circulated, or some of his citizens are circulated? But the way the Ramayana portrays it, that this is taking Dharma to its ultimate extreme, that this is not about him and about his feelings of as a person, but he is the king. He should uphold Dharma to its utmost extreme, and therefore, even if this means banishing the wife he loves dearly and cannot bear to live set apart from, he should do this, because this is what the ideal king does. And the Ramayana is full of stories like that, where you have these principles that are sort of put forward and then taken to their extreme, and that you kind of go like, oh, this is a bit difficult to take. But it's kind of portraying, this is a text that sort of portrays the ideal life of the Kshatriya, the ideal lives of the king, and says this is what you need to do to be an ideal king. The Mahabharata, by contrast, is an immensely messy text when it comes on when it comes to Dharma, because the Mahabharata, the one theme that runs through the Mahabharata is that Dharma is very complex and is very subtle, is very difficult to understand. It is not something that is set in stone, but something that needs to be always re-examined re-questioned. And as I said, the Mahabharata is the story of Krishna, who also appears in the, who is Vishnu, who appears in the in a sort of Kshatriya lineage, in a family of kings. But really, the Mahabharata is in some ways not about Krishna, but is about the people Krishna associates with. And just to give you a very brief summary of 10,000 verses, 100,000 verses. The basic story of the Mahabharata is that there are two sons who inherit the kingdom, or who are eligible to inherit the kingdom. There's Duryodhana, who is the eldest son, who should be king after his father passes away, but who's born blind and therefore is not seen to be fit to rule. Sorry? Dhritarashtra. Sorry, yeah. But who's born blind and is not seen to be, is fit to be a king, because his subjects would not have faith in him. And therefore, the throne goes to Pandu, to his younger brother. And Pandu has himself five sons. His eldest son is Yudhishthira. And then we have Arjuna, Bhima, and two twins, Nakula, were always mentioned together, and Sahadeva. And so Pandu becomes king. He has two wives, actually. Yudhishthira, Arjuna, and Bhima are sons of one wife, and Nakula and Sahadeva are sons of the second wife. He rules perfectly. He's a good king. His brother is happy for him to rule. But then Pandu dies at a fairly young age. So because Pandu was king, the throne would have to go to Yudhishthira, who is his eldest son. But Dhritarashtra himself has 100 sons, chief of which is Duryodhana. And Duryodhana claims that, well, because my father was supposed to be king, but he was born blind and therefore could not be king, and because I'm his eldest son, therefore I should be king. And so basically the Mahabharata is the story of the conflict between the sons of Pandu, who were called the Pandavas, and Duryodhana and the other sons of Dhritarashtra. And the entire Mahabharata is telling about that conflict that takes place. Krishna appears in the story because Krishna is an ally of the Pandavas, and he's particularly a very close friend with Arjuna, as we will see next week when we look at the Bhagavad Gita, which is a dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna. The whole story is about the conflict between these two and the attempt of Duryodhana to keep Yudhishthira away from the throne. And it's really a commentary on Kshatriya dharma, on the dharma of Kshatriyas, the dharma of kings. But unlike the Ramayana, which sort of portrays the ideal of Rama as the embodiment of dharma, as the most perfect king, here everything is much messier. And the Mahabharata never proclaims sort of a very clear-cut sort of standard for Kshatriya dharma, for what the Kshatriyas should pursue. The Mahabharata is definitely on the side of Yudhishthira in the narrative as a whole, although it does not sort of shy away from praising Duryodhana at times as well as a proper Kshatriya. What makes this complicated is that Yudhishthira, who's portrayed in the text as the ideal king, is the person who's most critical of everything to do with Kshatriya dharma. Yudhishthira is a great warrior, like all of them, but he loathes war. He hates violence, and he looks down upon the duties of a king. In a very famous passage, he says the dharma of Kshatriyas is the dharma of dogs. It is just dogs who are fighting with each other, and there's nothing noble about this. There's nothing noble about war. The Kshatriyas just impose suffering on the general people, and therefore everything that we're doing here is all sort of leading to greater suffering and greater injustice, and so on. By contrast, his brother Bhima, he sort of represents a very different ideal of Kshatriya dharma. He's the fierce warrior, mighty warrior, who's quick in applying justice in a very visceral way. And the story comes out, sort of the Mahabharata kind of plays with this throughout its narrative and sort of portraying these different ideals of Kshatriya dharma. But one of the stories where it sort of comes out most strongly is shortly after Yudhishthira and his brothers are banished similar to the Ramayana, where Ram was also banished here, the Pandavas spend a lot of time in exile in the Mahabharata, where they're banished from the kingdom and they have to live incognito in the wilderness for an extended period. And shortly after this, the five Pandavas have a single wife. They have all multiple wives, because Kshatriyas have multiple wives. But the five Pandavas have one wife in common, whose name is Draupadi. And the story is that she was won, her hand was won in sort of a contest for sort of the most heroic sort of warrior. Arjuna won her, right? Yeah, Arjuna won her, he went to his mother and said, you know, this is what I got, and He said, "Oh, I got something extraordinary." And his mother said, "Well, whatever it is, you have to share it with your brothers." And he said, "Oh, well, I got a wife." And she said, "Oh, well, I can't take back my word, so you have to share her with your brothers." And so she's the wife of all five of them. And Draupadi is in the text, she's sort of this force of nature. She's an immensely powerful woman who's also immensely beautiful and sort of disturbs all the kshatriyas. All the kshatriyas lust after her and fall in love with her instantly upon seeing her. And so shortly after they're exiled, sure enough, they're in the wilderness. This kshatriya passes by, falls instantly in love with Draupadi and says, "I will take you away." And she refuses his advances. And he more or less attempts to rape her. And her husbands kind of intervene. And the response to this, of what should be done to this person who committed such adharmic act, is Yudhishthira's approach is, he says, we should be tolerant, we should be forgiving, we should be kind, we should be compassionate. We should not sort of continue violence or reciprocate violence with violence. Bhima's response is, let's just, just beat him into the ground. Just beat him up and just smash him, and that there's nothing left of him. This is the proper response. And you kind of read the text and you kind of go like, I get Yudhishthira's point, but I also, on an emotional level, I get Bhima's point. And Draupadi particularly, although she's sort of portrayed as the ideal wife and she follows her husband, she's very critical, particularly of Yudhishthira. She, throughout the Mahabharata, she takes issues with Yudhishthira's sort of compassionate sort of approach and patient and non-violent approach. And she says, the whole mess we're in here is just because of you, because you are a coward and you do not dare to stand up for what is right, and you just let everyone walk over you. And so you get this sort of portrayal that this is portrayed as the ideal king, and yet throughout the Mahabharata, he's criticized for what he's doing. He's criticized as not being a good kshatriya, and yet at the same time, the Mahabharata says he is the best kshatriya. Ultimately, he becomes king, and he becomes king after a long war that is waged between the two sides of the family, which is the majority of the text is a description of this war. And it's a bloody war. It's according to the text, there's millions of people, millions of soldiers who die, and you get chapter after chapter of rivers of blood floating, where helmets are floating in them and decapitated limbs, decapitated heads are floating around and so on. And it's this gruesome description. And it's kind of, you get to the end of that and you go like, who wants war? And that's kind of the message of the text. It's a text about war, but it's a text that makes you detest war like no other. And it sort of portrays these kshatriyas as ideal warriors, but at the same time it is proclaiming that the highest dharma that there is ahimsa, is non-violence. And it has several long narrative sort of subplots that try to establish this as long didactic passages that proclaim ahimsa is the highest dharma that there is. Yudhishthira says, the entire Mahabharata is sort of an attempt to stop the war from happening in various ways through diplomacy, through all sorts of means. Ultimately, they realize the war has to happen. The war happens, and everyone sort of is devastated at the end of the war that this happens. It says that of the entire family, the only people that survive of all the warriors on the Pandava side who win, it's these five brothers are the ones that survive. Some of their children die, their uncles, their relatives, and their allies. Most of them are dead, and they're done. Yudhishthira is crowned king, and Yudhishthira goes, "What's the point of all this? Why all this bloodshed just to put me on the throne?" You get a long discourse on how Duryodhana was actually not a bad king at all, and would have, he was selfish, he was arrogant, he was full of himself, but he was just to his subjects, and therefore he would have been a proper king as well. And Yudhishthira said, "So why me? Why all this bloodshed just to get me on the throne?" But what the Mahabharata is trying to teach through all this is that it is saying that there is no one dharma. You cannot read a text and say, this is what dharma is, and this is applicable in all circumstances. And repeatedly he tells these stories, and tells the sort of the story of these five brothers and their conflict with their nephew, with their cousin, about to kind of point out that there is no one kshatriya dharma. There is no general principle, apart from ahimsa, which is the highest principle, but which in some cases can be broken to preserve sort of greater, more lives and so on. But it's kind of saying dharma is not set in stone. And the famous story that is told to illustrate this is the story where there's a Brahmin called Kaushitaki, who's a proper Brahmin who embodies all the brahminical virtues, chief of which is truthfulness. Truthfulness particularly to the truth of the Veda, the sort of the speech of the Veda, but truthfulness also in the sense that he will never tell a lie. And the story goes that he's living in a hermitage somewhere, and there's these people that are fleeing, that pass his hermitage, and they ask, they say, well, there's some robbers who are chasing us, who are about to kill us, you know, please tell us where we can hide. And he says, oh, over there's some caves, you can hide there and you'll be safe there. So they run off, they hide in the cave. Next, the robbers come by and they ask the Brahmin, he said, where are these people gone? And he said, oh, they're over there in the cave. And so the robbers go and they kill everyone in the cave. And then the Brahmin, you know, is punished later in the story for breaking dharma. And his sort of justification, he says, no, how can I be punished for this? Because I was truthful. And truthfulness is the highest dharma of a Brahmin. And it's sort of a simple story, but it's kind of the way that the Mahabharata sort of teaches that in this case, being untruthful would have been dharma, because it would have led to ahimsa, to non-violence and the preservation of life, and therefore this would have been the higher path to follow. Therefore, this is dharma. And this is sort of a very crude and sort of simple story, but in the portrayal of these different kshatriyas and the way they embody this, it's kind of making that same point. That yes, Yudhishthira is right in teaching non-violence and teaching compassion and teaching forgiveness, but Bhima is equally right in wanting swift and immediate justice, and so it's sort of, you know, you read the Dharma Shastras and you get a very clear picture. Here's what dharma is, and it's all sort of nice and clear and simple. You read the Mahabharata, and at the end you kind of go, okay, so what do we do now? You know, how am I supposed to live as a kshatriya king, if you are a kshatriya, obviously. But what makes all this more complicated is the role of Krishna, who is declared in the text to be the avatar of Vishnu, who descends to uphold dharma, and everything he does breaks dharma. It's during the war. Krishna is the advisor to the Pandavas, and he tells the Pandavas to tell lies, to break the roles of Kshatriya Dharma in combat. Yudhishthira's teacher is fighting in the opposite army, and there was a person called Dronacharya, who's a sort of a martial teacher. And a very fierce warrior, and Dronacharya vowed that he would continue to fight, and he would fight the Pandavas, and he seems like he's winning at that. The Pandavas, with the advice of Krishna, devised a plan that if they tell Dronacharya that his son Ashwatthama has died, Dronacharya will lose all will to fight and will give up the fight, and the Pandavas will stand a chance. But Ashwatthama is not dead. Ashwatthama is still very much alive. But Krishna advises Yudhishthira that he says, you should go to Dronacharya and you should tell Drona that his son is dead. Because if it comes from you, you're known as the embodiment of Dharma who never tells a lie. Therefore, he will believe it. And Yudhishthira goes, but how can I do this? How can I tell a lie? This is a fundamental breach of Dharma. But ultimately, Krishna convinces him to tell it. In the way that Bhima goes and kills an elephant called Ashwatthama. And so Yudhishthira can go before Dronacharya and say, Ashwatthama is dead, without telling a lie. which makes Dronacharya, of course, believe that his son called Ashwatthama is dead, which make him lose sort of the will to continue the war. And so in this way, similarly, Duryodhana is invincible in battle, except his weak spot are his thighs. Now, you can't, according to Kshatriya code, you cannot hit a Kshatriya below the waist. That is a breach of Dharma. Krishna instructs Bhima to hit Duryodhana there, because that's the way he can defeat Duryodhana. And so you have Krishna, who's supposed to uphold Dharma, who's constantly breaking all the principles of Dharma. And you get sort of a very different view of how the avatar comes to embody Dharma. Rama embodies Dharma because he's the ideal king. Krishna embodies, or Krishna is related to Dharma because he transcends Dharma. Dharma is the way the Mahabharata portrays it. Because Vishnu is Brahman, who upholds the Ritta, and the Ritta is upheld by Dharma. Therefore, to follow the command of Vishnu, in this case of Krishna, is the higher Dharma. And so Yudhishthira is his refusal to tell a lie. It's the one weak, the one sort of blemish on his character when it comes to Dharma is his hesitation to tell that lie that Ashwatthama is dead. Because the Mahabharata says, Krishna has descended for Dharma, and his command is there for Dharma. And in that case, for Yudhishthira to tell that lie, that would have been following the command of Krishna, and therefore that would have been Dharma, that would have been proper thing to do. So it gets very complicated and very messy in all this. But it makes for very interesting reading, and makes the story really come to life, and makes the story interesting, because you can see the same theme looked at from various perspectives, and you can sort of side with all of them and kind of see the rationale of all of them. Next week we'll look at an episode in the Mahabharata that occurs just before the war is starting. The armies have gathered on the battlefield. The war is about to happen, and Arjuna, the fiercest warrior among the Pandavas, asks Krishna, who acts as his charioteer during the war, he says, please show me who has come to fight in this war. And Krishna will drive the chariot in between the armies. Arjuna sees everyone who's gathered on the other side of the army, and he breaks down and he says, how can I fight these people? These people are my teachers, are my relatives. This is adharmic to fight, and he decides not to fight, very much embodying the sort of voicing the concerns of Yudhishthira throughout the Mahabharata. And Krishna will then teach him in 18 chapters, and sort of telling him finally you have to go and fight. This is, we've tried everything to avoid this war. This war is about to happen. It is your duty now to fight in this. And this is the text known as the Bhagavad Gita, which is a very influential text that comes to be sort of seen as a text on its own right, but really has to be seen in the context of the broader narrative of the Mahabharata. So we'll come to that next week.